couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Bad Boys for Life, Doolittle, Six Underground, and the television series Medical Police. I'm also going to be talking about some news of the Trailer Park and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news I want to follow up on is last Sunday's Critics' Choice Awards. The one that won Best Picture, but not Best Director, was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which, you know, that's one of those easy bets because it's all about nostalgia for Hollywood. And even though I've never lived in Hollywood, I can see where a lot of film fans, especially ones that are maybe of a generation slightly older than me, you know, somebody in their sort of that late baby boomer generation would still love that because they grew up with that. And that's when Hollywood was still kind of idealized. The thing I found most interesting about the Critics' Choice Awards is it seems to have galvanized the fact that Joaquin Phoenix and Renee Zellweger are probably going to win the Best Actor and Actress Oscars because they both got the Golden Globes for those and they've got these CCAs. They've both been nominated for Oscars. Brad Pitt and Laura Dern also look like they've got a good shot at winning for Best Supporting Actor and Actress because they both won the Critics' Choice Awards. A couple things I noticed. I like the fact that The Irishman got something, you know, it got Best Acting Ensemble, but it didn't get as much as I really had hoped. It was one of my favorite movies of the year. So Greta Gerwig got her little bit of love for Little Women, but she didn't get much else. And that's okay, because I did not think that Little Women was a triumph that everyone seems to think it is. I think also Greta Gerwig kind of, I love Greta Gerwig. I think she's a great talent, but I'm afraid people are throwing all this heaping praise on her because she's a good director at a young age. And I think they may be overselling her at this point. I mean, Lady Bird was good. Little Women was good for what it was, but I still think she has her best years are ahead of her. So the problem with when you win an Oscar or get nominated and get so much artistic pressure at this point, you may not be able to follow through. I mean, look what happened with John Singleton. He came on really strong, and in later years, he really did struggle to make solid movies. So I hope that Greta Gerwig isn't just pinning our hopes on an early Oscar. Speaking of Oscars, the Oscar nominations were this week, and by this time, you kind of know what's going to be out there. It's not a big surprise who got nominated, and Best Actor is going to be Joaquin Phoenix for Joker. Best Actress is going to be Renee Zellweger for Judy. I think it was neat to see Kathy Bates get a supporting nomination. Florence Pugh, I think, is who deserves it for Little Women, but I think it's probably going to end up going to Laura Dern. The big surprise I found was an animated film where Klaus actually got a nomination, which was that Netflix film about Santa Claus, and not Frozen 2, which is a huge surprise considering how beloved that movie was. You know, I'd love to see The Irishman get some more stuff because it was one of my favorite movies of the year. It's one of those, I think it's going to be really fighting against, well, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for the Hollywood nostalgia, but also 1917. You cannot discount that one. It is more than just a dark horse at this point. The last piece of news I want to talk about is something I saw popping up on social media, and it's about Little Women. I've talked about this many times before, but it always is worth repeating. There's this discussion going on where people saying, is it a spoiler to reveal certain plot points in Little Women? And the arrogant a-hole response is, well, you've had like 100 years to read the book. It's been around as a book and they've made a bunch of movies. So it's your fault. No, it's not. Look, people, don't spoil stuff. that always turns into the narrative of somebody saying, well, if it's well made and it's a good narrative, it's not really a spoiler because you can either see it coming or it's more about how the characters react to the situation. No. If you've never seen Little Women, that's not your fault. Heck, they haven't made a Little Women movie since, what, the 90s? And the book is, I mean, the book's 100 years old, but there's a lot of books that are 100 years old. Don't be a jerk and don't spoil things. And I hate that sort of mansplaining that people do when they're like, oh, no, really, because if it's a good story, you can't spoil it. Shut up. And I've always said, my comparison, and I've said this before, dropping a spoiler is like farting in an elevator or farting at the dinner table. You may not care, but everyone around you does, and it's rude to do, and it's unnecessary. Next time you're out at a really nice fancy dinner, you're meeting your boyfriend or girlfriend's parents for the first time, rip a big fart. And then when somebody goes, oh my God, I go, oh no, really, it's okay, because it's just the natural process. It's really not bad. It's nothing wrong. It's not poisonous gas. It just smells weird, but that's okay. Eat your food. Enjoy your soup. People, don't spoil things. Don't be the jerk. If you can't talk about a movie in general context and keep spoilers out of a headline, or at least give a spoiler warning to say, hey, look, you know, this is what's happening in the last half of the movie. I'm going to talk about it. If you don't want to read about it, don't read about it or listen about it. Just be nice to each other. Yeah, I have always lived by the principle of Bill and Ted. Be excellent to each other and party on, dude. And that is my philosophy. And I wish more people followed that instead of these lame brain film Twitter know-it-alls. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about is Brahms, The Boy 2. This is, of course, the sequel to The Boy. It opens next month, February 21st.
I understand that some of Jude's behaviors would be upsetting, but I urge you to find a place where he feels safe. I think it will be good for him. Good for all of us.
Oh, my goodness. Look at that. That must be the main house. Come on, Jude.
Jude. It looks like he was broken before and put back together.
Who's this handsome chap?
Brahms.
How'd you come up with that?
He tells me all sorts of things.
I thought The Boy was actually a pretty decent movie for a film that was not screened, and I had to wait to see it on video because I didn't get a chance to go see it in the theaters. That movie was okay. It does kind of steal some elements and bits from this, I think it's an Australian or it's a New Zealand movie called Housebound. So it has some connective tissue there where I think these were two movies that had a very similar idea and they both came out around the same time. But I'm curious to see where they go with this because the trailer looks like they're pulling in some interesting supernatural elements. I don't know if they're going to follow through. I just hope that all the cool stuff you see in the trailer isn't like dream sequences and hallucinations. The next one I want to talk about is Morbius, which comes from Sony Pictures. It opens on July 31st.
I have a rare blood disease, and I'm running out of time. This could be my last chance. This would be a cure.
What's happening?
I went from dying to feeling more alive than ever. Increased strength and speed, the ability to use echolocation, and an overpowering urge to consume blood.
I'm Batman. No, this is not Batman. I can totally see the pitch of this where they're saying, oh yeah, it's a superhero and he uses echolocation and he drinks blood. I'm Batman. No, you're not Batman. You're not Batman. Batman's on a different, well, that's DC. This is Marvel. You're a vampire. I'm Batman. It's so hard to watch this trailer and not think Batman. It's Batman. Nope. It's a vampire. Venom, I think, was a fluke that it did as well as it did and was as enjoyable to watch as it was. I feel a real Venom quality to this, but filled with the pretension of Jared Leto's acting. Maybe Jared Leto is just mad that Batman doesn't want his Joker anymore. And so he decided to be his own Batman. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be reviewing Six Underground and Bad Boys for Life.
Bad
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. The first one I'm going to review is not actually new. It came out about a month ago on Netflix, but it's been so busy at Christmas and the New Year and the end of the year stuff and the best of the year and the worst of the year and award season. I thought I'd review this movie. I was curious about it. Here's the background. Six Underground is directed by Michael Bay, and it was one of these wins for Netflix to get this because he's a major director. I mean, look, I think he's an idiot, but that doesn't change the fact that he's an A-list director. He's directed some huge movies. Of course, he did all the Transformers movies, and those are huge money makers globally, even though they're not making that much money domestically anymore because he ground that franchise into the dust. But it was an interesting thing that Michael Bay had this movie, and I didn't hear much about it. I heard all about The Irishman and, you know, even The Two Popes, Dolomite Is My Name. I mean, all these movies that are hitting Netflix. I mean, kind of remember last year, Bird Box? But Six Underground, I would have expected them to promote that a little bit more, but I really didn't see much promotion. I mean, it felt like one of those Adam Sandler movies that just drops on Netflix and people are like, oh, yeah, it's time to watch that. I thought it was interesting to go back and look at Six Underground. And the reason I wanted to talk about it this week is because we've got Bad Boys for Life, which Michael Bay did not direct. And I think that plays insignificantly to the Bad Boys for Life review, which will be here in a minute. But first, let's talk about Six Underground. Michael Bay directs his action film about a group of independently funded mercenaries who get rid of bad guys around the world. Go, 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 go!
We do the dirty work, others can't. Here's the fun part.
Now on,
you're dead. It's all erased.
Watch me!
Is this gonna work?
I hope so.
Okay, this trailer I played with all that noise and all that stuff, that's what it is like watching this movie. I did not purposely add that stuff into the trailer. That's in the trailer. I was at the theater the other day, and they have a sign out there warning people that The Rise of Skywalker has that strobe effects that could induce seizures if you're susceptible to that. If you're like that, don't watch Six Underground. This movie is like the first scene. It's like literally a 20-minute car chase through Italy. And okay, first of all, let's just put this out there. It looks cool. There's some great stunts. It really, as a stunt reel, Michael Bay stuff is pretty good. I mean, it's a pile of crap, but it's a very nicely polished, shiny, beautifully lit pile of crap. But a movie's got to be more than just fast cars and explosions and hot Italian women on Vespas, which just, I mean, it's such beer commercial filmmaking. It's hard to even watch at times. The movie is incoherent. It is loud and bombastic, and it fills its breathing room with click, click, click and noises and flashing lights. And it has these action sequences and then puts these things in there to distract you from the fact that there's no substance to it. And then they have stuff that distracts you from the distractions. It is that hard to follow. I mean, it's a pretty relatively simple story. Ryan Reynolds plays this guy who's independently wealthy because he created some tech device that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But he then uses that to fund this group of mercenaries who, you know, they go against the bad guys and they're trying to overthrow a government. It's apparently based on a book, and I imagine the book's way better. But the movie is just awful. It is so hard to watch. And one of the best things about it is it's not in the theaters, because I can't imagine this thing blown up to a big screen. It would be incomprehensible. And yeah, some of the stunts are cool. I mean, like I said, it's just a series of stunt reels, but it reminds me of these movies. You know, it reminds me of a David Goyer movie. I don't know if you remember who he was. He got a lot of noise about 10, 12 years ago. He helped write The Dark Knight, and earlier in the 2000s, he wrote a lot of scripts, but then he started to direct stuff, and you found that his directing movies were all cool shots, but they didn't fit together. It's like watching a trailer for a horror movie, and it's got all these really cool things happening, and then when you watch them in the movie, they don't make sense. You know, when it was like that, The Grudge the other week was like that. It has these kind of creepy moments, but they don't even know how to address them, and they just throw it out there and just like, hey, we had this idea. I don't know how to connect it to the rest of the movie, but here it is. And that's what I feel like this film is. 600, it's like over 2 hours long. It probably has about 15 minutes of, maybe 15 minutes of story. So yeah, Six Underground is incomprehensible and a mess. If you like Michael Bay, it's exactly what you want, but it is garbage. So it sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now we get to talk about Bad Boys for Life. And this is interesting because, like I said, it's not directed by Michael Bay. And I find that good because I felt he's such a vapid film director. It's like, hand off a property to somebody else. Like the Transformers movie. How many Transformers movies? Give somebody else a chance. And then they did that Bumblebee movie, and the Bumblebee movie is actually really good. It has a story and characters and a coherent plot, and you can actually follow the action on screen. And unfortunately, the Transformers franchise has been pushed down so much that Michael Bay's ruined it. They kind of have to let it sit and die for about 10 years, and then they can resurrect it and maybe do something good with it with a decent director. And the Bad Boys movies, I feel, are kind of the same way. Not that they were great to ever begin with, but at least the first Bad Boys movie, he had something to prove. It was his first film. It was the first film with Will Smith. Let's play the trailer here. Miami detectives Marcus and Mike take a look at the dangerous careers as family pressures and the realities of the job force them to consider retirement.
I'm done, Mike. I'm retiring.
Uh-oh, here we go again.
You want your legacy to be muscle shirts and body counts?
Look at this mess. It's carnage.
I didn't do all this.
You didn't shoot anybody?
Well, come on, Cap. You know I shot some people.
Yeah.
In these streets, I never trusted anybody but you. I'm asking you, man. Bad Boys.
One last time.
One last time.
Okay, the story's not good, but I will say this about Bad Boys for Life. It tries to ape Michael Bay, but it doesn't have that coked up frenzy that Michael Bay has, although it still is clearly making a Michael Bay kind of movie. It takes all of these elements of 90s and early 2000 action movies and just kind of throws them on the screen. And I don't even know if they're aware of it, but it's sort of almost at a certain point satirizes itself. But I don't think they mean to. It's just they go so over the top and they so dive into the cliches, but there's no wink and a nod to the audience. It's one of these movies that I think honestly that they made saying, hey, you know, in 20 years, people are going to get it. Otherwise, people are going to think it's the greatest action movie ever. And it has some great moments. It has some good action sequences, but it brings back all the stuff, you know, where you'd have these massive changes and there was no amount of property damage. Was too much. No amount of innocent lives being put in danger is enough to justify stopping the chase. It's a fun action movie. And I will say Martin Lawrence is actually really funny in it. And it goes back to what I think Bad Boys originally was going to be, was Martin Lawrence being funny. And I mean, Will Smith is still doing his cool swagger thing, which I guess kind of works, but honestly, he was the less compelling character in the film. I mean, it was Martin Lawrence that actually made this. He's the one that made me enjoy watching it. So I'm going to have to say Bad Boys for Life, God help me, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Doolittle and Medical Police. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Doolittle. Robert Downey Jr. stars as the classic literary icon, an eccentric professor who knows how to communicate with many different animals.
Are you Dr. Doolittle?
We have no choice but to embark on this perilous journey.
You can talk to animals.
Somehow, we just belong together.
I actually read a handful of the Dr. Dolittle books when I was like about fourth grade. I didn't read all of them, but I mean, there were a whole bunch of them. I don't know how many there were, but I mean, these books are like 100 years old. They were written early part of the 20th century, I believe. And they take place in sort of Victorian England. And I remember when they made the Eddie Murphy movies back in the 90s. And that was fine because, I mean, I know they were just going for sort of like goofy family comedy. But the Eddie Murphy as Dr. Dolittle was nothing at all like what Dr. Dolittle was in the books. I mean, if you go back and watch the Rex Harrison movie, yeah, that's a little more like Dr. Dolittle. It was an adventure. It was Dr. Dolittle, and he had his sidekicks, which were these kids. God knows why he was taking on these kids on dangerous adventures, but we did that at that time, I guess. And they'd get on ships, and they'd go to distant lands, and they'd meet other animals elsewhere. And I remember the thing that was the catch was he could actually converse in the animal's language. And that I always thought was really fascinating because the whole thing was he studied animals so much, and he was kind of a pariah. He didn't like people. But he liked animals, and he learned how to speak like horse and dog and gorilla and giraffe. When they made the Eddie Murphy movies, I forget exactly what the catch was, but I think it was just he just sort of like magically understood animals. He just had a knack for understanding what animals thought, and he could communicate with them. And then it became a lot of poop and fart jokes because he was a veterinarian, so he had to take temperatures and stuff like that. But it was just him living in the suburbs and dealing with animals there. You did not get the grand adventure that the original Dr. Dolittle books were. And the first thing I thought when I saw this movie, and I even said this to the rep when I left, I said, I appreciate the fact that they go back to the source material. They jettisoned the Eddie Murphy family kitsch, and they're trying to make an adventure movie for kids. There's when they first show up and Dolittle first shows up and this kid sneaks into is on his property and looks at him through the window. He's there talking gorilla to a gorilla, and he's talking mouse to a mouse and dog to a dog and bird to a bird. And I was like, okay. And then they find a way to cinematically explain what's going on. And then of course the animals all have voices, but I like the fact that they went back to the fact that he could communicate in their own language. And also from what I remember, again, you know, I read these books, what, 40 years ago or something. It reminded me of what Dr. Dolittle was, where they had to go find some adventure. They had some sort of MacGuffin they have to find. And then this one, it's this tree that has this potion or something that's supposed to save the queen. And it's them trying to track it down and on the high seas and big adventure. And, you know, the story's rough. There is a moment after right around when the first act turns into the second act and they're on their adventure. There's Emma Thompson. I think it's Emma Thompson. She plays a parrot that narrates the beginning and then suddenly jumps in and narrates in the middle. Now, one of the things you'll notice is if you ever see enough movies, and I figure this out because I watch movies for a living, when narration just shows up out of the blue, it's usually there to cover something. They're usually covering some sort of editing issue. And it looks like they had a whole sequence where they travel to this distant land and have to show up and they have to know why they're there. And they had to compress it for time because probably the original cut was like 3 hours and they couldn't figure out a way to make it work. And so they had to narrate and kind of squeeze it together at this point. So it has these weird, awkward, choppy moments in the script and the pacing. And also Robert Downey Jr. does this weird accent. He speaks in a weird cadence. And that's a little bit off-putting. But you know what? If I were 10, I would have probably enjoyed this movie. I mean, yeah, is it a great film? Is it deep conversation and excellent characterization? Not really. But it's kids going on an adventure with a crazy man who can speak to animals. It's actually kind of a cool movie. I enjoyed it for what it is. I mean, it's not great, but I found it enjoyable. And of course, it's getting creamed in the press because everybody wants to dump on movies. It's we're having the same effect that we had when Cats came out. Cats wasn't a great movie, but it's not nearly as bad as people made it sound. People are losing their minds over Bad Boys, and Bad Boys for Life's not that good. and they're dumping all over Doolittle just because they're like, oh, it's stupid kid stuff. Well, yeah, there's nothing wrong. There is nothing wrong with releasing a movie for kids. Not every single kid's movie needs to be this, you know, heavy, well-plotted thing like, you know, the stuff that Pixar does. It's okay to just have a fun, goofy, throwaway kids movie. Those are fun. Those are fine. And I think this works. You want to take the kids to the cinemas this weekend? Take them to see this. So I'm going to have to say that Doolittle kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about medical police. From the creators of Children's Hospital, this Netflix comedy series follows two doctors thrust into the world of fighting international terrorism.
Excuse me. You know where I could find some cool crime-fighting doctors?
This virus is killing people, and soon it'll be too late to stop it.
We're a secret division of the CDC. We hunt down two things, diseases and criminals.
Who's behind this? We want answers.
What kind of God would make a virus like that? God's not the bad guy here. We suspect bioterrorism.
We are the police, and we're doctors, which makes us...
cop doctors.
Oh, I was going to say Dr. Cops. I like that better.
First of all, you have to know Children's Hospital and the type of humor. It's run by David Wayne. And like David Wayne and a bunch of other actors and performers come from this old sketch comedy group called The State. It used to be on MTV. And you see a lot of the characters showing up in stuff like Reno 911. If you watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, the guy who plays Charles, he used to be on this as well. David Wayne and Rob Corddry, I think, are the guys behind Children's Hospital. And that was a series on, I think, Adult Swim. So Netflix had done a 10-episode run of this half-hour comedy, which is Medical Police. And it spoofs both, not cop shows, but sort of like that international terrorism show. Stuff like when they did that series Whiskey Tango or something like 24 or Alias. But it's more like they're fighting terrorism. It's not just a cop show because they're not just on the streets in New York. They're international. They're going all over the place and they have access to all these technologies. But they're also doctors. And so at the same time, it's sort of spoofing the doctor drama, stuff like Grey's Anatomy. You gotta have the right sense of humor to watch this stuff. You gotta know what they're doing because they're spoofing both types of shows, but also just doing an overt comedy. It stars Rob Hubble, who has been in a bunch of stuff. He's shown up in The League, and Erin Hayes, she was also in The League. She was on that show way back about 10, 15 years ago called Kitchen Confidential with Bradley Cooper before he became big. And they're the stars of it, and they're very funny because they're both good comedians, and they both have great timing. They work well together. But it's an absurd show. It is ridiculous. But you know how I said, like, with Bad Boys for Life, it feels like they were making a satire of action movies, where I don't think they actually were. They just went so deep into the cliches that it also works as a satire. This one, they're aware of it. There's an irreverence to it. And if you've ever watched some of David Wayne's stuff, they're the people who also were involved in Wet Hot American Summer. That was another one that David Wayne and that group of people worked on. If you like their kind of stuff, it's very funny, and it has that, it connects right in with Children's Hospital. So if you liked Children's Hospital, they spin right off of that. It literally starts in Children's Hospital, but of course they go off and do other things. Anyways, I gotta say Medical Police is a lot of fun. It doesn't take very long to watch. It's like 25 minutes each episode and there's only 10 of them. So you can binge that over a weekend. I'm gonna have to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about diversity in award season, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. Two Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. It's interesting to point this out and address this, because this has been a thing in the Oscars in specific and award season in general for years. And that is the diversity of the Oscars. Now, remember a couple years ago, and it was a while ago, I remember because Will Smith wasn't nominated for something like Concussion. And Jada Pinkett Smith was like, I'm not going to go to the ceremony because you didn't honor enough people of color and there's not enough nominees. And you got this again where people are like, oh, it's all white men. Okay, I get that. I understand the accusation and the complaint, and I get that. But sort of like woke film Twitter that drives that, because it's a hashtag driven thing, and it's been that way for years because it used to be hashtag Oscar so white. I finally realized what bothered me this year about it is they're like, oh, you didn't pick any women in your director category because Greta Gerwig didn't get enough. Oh, I guess Little Women directed itself. And like, well, no, you have like 9 nominees for Best Picture and 5 nominees for Best Director. You're clearly going to be leaving some of them off. And I've never been a big fan of the term snubs. Like Jennifer Lopez was not nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Hustlers. And she shouldn't have. First of all, that wasn't that good of a role. She acted more when she was in Geely. But the way film Twitter that pushes this sort of overly woke film Twitter, they imply that it's this group of people get together and they say, okay, let's make sure we don't get any women in these categories and let's make sure the people of color don't get it. People vote with what they have seen. Now, granted, there's people of the Academy who there's a lot of movies they haven't seen. And I understand because there are hundreds of movies that come out and there is a stack of screeners you get at the end of the year and you can't possibly get through all of them. And I know there's people like going, oh, The Last Black Man in San Francisco didn't get any nominations. Maybe part of that was just it didn't get as big of a release and it wasn't promoted to the Academy audience as much. And maybe, you know, because there's not just like film critics, there are people who work in the industry and they don't get to spend their whole week going to see movies like somebody like I can. So the reality is people just vote with what they've seen and what they think is the best. Now, here's the reality of Hollywood. Most of Hollywood, like if you talk about like the award group in Hollywood, they, especially the ones that have been around long enough and have fostered a career, people like Sam Mendes or Martin Scorsese, they're going to be old white guys. I'm sorry. That's just the way it is. There were not the opportunities for women and minorities to direct major motion pictures back in the 80s or 70s or 60s, and there were a lot of fringe work, and that's wrong, and that's too bad, but you can't change the past. You can't change the fact that the people who have been doing this for decades and have really mastered the craft are these old white guys. In 30 years, Greta Gerwig's going to have all this under her belt, and yeah, she's going to have a long history of directing films, and she will have honed her craft perfectly. But she's not at the point of Martin Scorsese yet. I mean, I'm sorry, she just isn't. And I know there's been a lot of talk of saying, well, we need to change it, but how do you change it? Aside from making sure you're bean counting and say, well, we got to do this, we got to make sure there's enough people of color, and not just black people, but Hispanics and Asians as well, and Indians and Pakistani and Arab, and all those different people get represented. That's not how award shows work. That's not how the nomination process works at all. You have to fix Hollywood first. And they're working on it. They've done some outreach. Cheryl Boone Isaacs did a whole bunch of stuff where she brought in new talent into the Academy. And so you've got younger talent, but you still got old people in there. And you can't just kick out the old people because they don't watch as many diverse movies as you want them to. You fix Hollywood, you get more women directing, you get more people of color directing, and you have a diversified cast. And then it will come. It's sort of the field of dreams here. You have to build it before they come. And you have to build it first. And we're still changing it. But it's going to take 20, 30 years for the age of people to get up and more people to be picked into the Academy when they're younger. So this business about the Academy Awards being overly, yes, it's white and male, but that's more a reflection of Hollywood. That's more indicative of what you're working with. And then when you're talking best of the year, you're talking about people who've been doing it for years. So if you make changes this year, it's going to take 10, 20 years for those changes to really be reflected in the award season. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the box office really quick. Last week, it wasn't a big surprise, but a big hit was 1917. that was a huge hit. It had been in limited release at Christmas in only a couple theaters in New York and LA. It got its wide release last week. It got $37 million, which did really well. It's not the highest grossing military movie, but military movies tend to do well in January. I'm not exactly sure why, but they really do well in January. It knocked Star Wars off its pedestal as the number one, which is okay. Star Wars still made $15 million last week. That was its fourth week of release. It's pushing towards $500 million. It's not going to make the same money that The Last Jedi did, but it's still going to be well over $500 million domestic. It's already over $1 billion worldwide. It still is a massive hit. There's nothing to be ashamed about for Disney or J.J. Abrams or anybody else involved in Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker. And then everything just got, like a Boss came in at number four with $10 million. Underwater was at $7 million. That's kind of, I imagine that's a little disappointing for what they were hoping, especially with an anchor star like Kristen Stewart. Of course, this week it's going to be Bad Boys for Life. So look for that one. I can't imagine anything else beating that. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. Of course, Maleficent being the super evil witch sorceress from Sleeping Beauty. And she's one of the best Disney villains because she is so evil in the movie. But of course, they give her a softer side with Angelina Jolie. But let's talk about the Blu-ray, which is out now. On the eve of Aurora's wedding, Maleficent comes in peace, but the queen schemes to pin her down with another war with the magical creatures in the forest.
I remember the story of an evil witch.
When I look out my window,
and the princess she cursed to sleep forever.
Many sights to see.
The story became legend.
And when I look in,
but this is no fairy tale.
I'm sure your kind would agree.
If I didn't know better, I'd say you were making a threat.
This movie was okay. I remember thinking the first Maleficent was okay. What saves it is Angelina Jolie. She's a very good performer, and she looks really good. And I mean, she looks good in the role. I'm not just being lecherous, although she's attractive. She fits the role really well. But you've got Michelle Pfeiffer as the bad queen. And it's got some great special effects, and it looks good. The problem is the story is a little bit left to be desired. It's a little bit cliche. It's predictable. I give it credit for trying to do something more and enriching the world outside of the original Sleeping Beauty and what was originally set down in the original Maleficent. Because the Maleficent, the first one, it was a troubled movie. It did very well. This one didn't do as well. I think it's because no one really wanted a sequel. I think Maleficent could have been a standalone. There's a lot of movies that do well enough, but then when they make a sequel, people are like kind of going, well, I didn't really want a sequel to that. I like the first movie, but I don't need a sequel. Because it's not an ongoing story. You know, you can do Superman and do as many sequels as you want with Superman because, you know, that's kind of how the character's designed, not this one. But it's fine. I mean, what's interesting is the original Maleficent's not on Disney Plus yet. I don't think it's going to show up there for another couple months because of rights issues. So it's kind of hard to go back and watch it unless you got the DVD or Blu-ray of it. Now, the Blu-ray of Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, Disney loves to give names to the different editions. They call this one the multi-screen edition because they have a Blu-ray, the DVD, and they have a digital code so you can watch it, you know, through Movies Anywhere. What's nice about it is that it comes with a Blu-ray because Disney preserves the older formats as much as pushing into the newer formats with streaming because there still are kids that have crappy DVD players that are plugged into a crappy TV in their house. So you can watch that and you can keep your Blu-ray pristine. There's not a ton of special features and Disney, it doesn't load up their standard release DVDs and Blu-rays with a lot of special features. There's some. They've got some extended scenes and outtakes and some smaller stuff in there, but it's not like you don't get this massive Criterion-level release. So this is really more of a release that if you like the movie or you want to keep the movie, even if you got Disney Plus, you know, it never hurts to have the physical copy somewhere just in case something happens with the rights. Cause like I said, you can't get the original Maleficent on Disney Plus yet. But still, I'm going to have to say Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, the Blu-ray for a buy and a treat for the kids It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Gentleman, Run, The Turning, and The Last Full Measure. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.